Good morning.
I'm very grateful again to be with you. If you weren't here for class, good morning to you. And I have again my wife and boys with me. You know, I was listening to Ray to talk about who I am a little bit in a couple of sentences, and mentioning the Masters of New Testament. Let me tell you a secret: I have not mastered the New Testament. I always find that title a little presumptuous. I have mastered where the New Testament is in Scripture, but I am grateful to continue to learn, to continue to be here with you. And every time I come back to Fried Hardeman, there are always incredible feelings. It's another home, and I'm especially grateful to be here with you this morning. My boys, they're old, a little bit older now. Now that they're three, we may set our alarm for a certain time to get up, but usually they are the alarm. So they will come in and just bust through the door, and you hear it. And sometimes it's just, it's so early. You look outside, and it's still dark, and you just laid your head down, and you hear the footsteps running through, and you hope. And sometimes it sounds like maybe like sometimes it's the similar sound to a squirrel running on the roof. So sometimes you wish it's a squirrel, you wish it's anything other than little child feet. But they come in there and wake us up early. But before that, when they were still sleeping in cribs, before they could get out of the cage and could not run in there, you know, we came and got them in the morning. And you never knew really what kind of reaction you were going to get in the morning. Sometimes you came in and they were all smiles. And they're happy, and they're ready to see you, and sometimes you came in there, and they're not happy because you have slept until noon, and you forgot about them, and you came, okay, that doesn't happen always, but sometimes you come in, and they're not happy, they're ready to get out, etc. Sometimes you know what you're going to get halfway down the hall because you could smell it, and repainting a couple of times. And it's always interesting to know what you're going to get in the morning when you have small children. You just never know. But it's nothing with my boys compared to what Khun Samong's dad had in India when he walked in and found in his son's bed, curled up with him, a 4-foot baby python. So I want you to imagine walking into your baby's room with this 4-foot python. What do? You try to kill it, right? You grab a shoe, you grab a hammer. I don't know why you got a hammer in your baby's room, but you grab something and you try to kill this thing and get rid of it, right? Not Khun Samong's dad. He takes the snake and he releases it into the wild. Yeah, he just lets it go. But here's the strange thing. The next morning, it was back, curled up with his son again. And he took it and he released it into the wild. He did this 3 times. And then finally, the 4th time the snake was back, he decided the snake had a thing for his son, so he's just going to leave it there and let them be friends. The snake wasn't hurting anybody, but so he just decided to leave it. It's bizarre to me, right? I mean, if we had a stray dog or something like that, I might decide to leave it and keep it. But a snake? A python? Well, this python, 7 years later, has grown up and become his friend. He's named it Lucky, affectionately. It is his sister. This snake, as you can see here, he sleeps with the snake. He rides on the snake like a hover round. Look at that. He sits on the snake and rides her around on the ground. They eat together. She has become accustomed to regularly scheduled feeding times, the same times that Khun eats, and they have become best friends. It's one of the strangest symbiotic relationships that we've ever seen in nature. Kevin Richardson is a zoologist who has studied these two together and how Lucky perceives herself to be a best friend and almost sibling of this child. And he has warned the parents that if one day they decide to get rid of Lucky, that they need to give her to a zoo or to an observatory or somewhere. They cannot release her into the wild. Why? She's been domesticated. Domesticated is the word we use when we take an animal into the house and we treat it in a way it doesn't get to evolve its natural instincts. And so because of that, it doesn't live in the wild. It doesn't know how to survive in the wild. And an animal that has been domesticated, we estimate, doesn't even develop their survival skills to even half of what they could be because they were never made to. And so you can't let them go into the wild because they will not survive. Let me ask you a question. Where are you? Hang on to that for just a second. Where are you? Looking back a year ago from today, What were you doing? You're climbing the spiritual ladder like all of us, and you're trying to reach the top. You're trying to get closer to God. You're trying to become more like Christ. What rung were you on? Or have you moved down a couple rungs? Have you moved up? Are you standing on the same place? Where are you? Are you still going the same places, fellowshipping with the same people, still studying, still praying in the same way, the same habits, still dealing with the same struggles in the same way, not conquering them any more, any less, etc.? Where are you? A lot of times we don't move, we don't progress, we don't go any further because we've been domesticated. We've grown comfortable within the four walls of a church. Well, okay, I don't know how many walls there are in here. Generally, in the four walls of a church building, and it's like a cage. We come for regularly scheduled feeding times on Sunday mornings and sometimes Sunday nights and maybe Wednesday nights, etc. And we rely on those to feed us or rely on professionals from here to feed us, and that's what we get. But we leave here and that's all. This is the cage in which we get fed and we become domesticated. And we never develop our spiritual potential really to even half of what it could be. Why? Because we were never made to. Because we never put ourselves out there and get involved to develop those things. In the same way that Lucky will not survive if you let her go into the wild, domesticated Christians will not have a faith that survives for very long either. In class, we talked about strategies to keep your faith from dying. We talked about study and prayer and accountability and involvement. But I want to go beyond just keeping your faith from dying to a faith that survives being domesticated and never finding your true spiritual potential and unique place in the church, because you never reach out to try to find that part of your mission in life. Jesus did not set us free to live in a cage. That's for sure. Jesus came to set us free, and he says that. But what he set us free to do is not to open the door of the cage and have the opportunity to get out there and be bold and courageous and do things for Christ. But say, for right now, I'm going to sit in here. I appreciate the door open. And when I'm ready, I'll take that. I'll leave the door, but just leave it open there. And when I'm ready, I'll move out. But Jesus set us free. Jesus died and suffered for us so that we could live life to the fullest and be able to reach out to other people who have not yet been set free from sin. Romans 12, verses 1 through 2 are familiar to us, that we offer our bodies as living sacrifices, and it's a reasonable service for us. From what's been done, this is reasonable that you would do such a thing. But then he says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Do not be conformed to this world. You think about the word conformed. How many of you, when you go to the doctor's office, read magazines? I ask that question sometimes, and I never anymore, I get this look like, we have these. We don't read those anymore. But even though I go to the doctor's office, there's still one magazine I'm looking for. It's a child's magazine. It's the Highlights magazine. How many of you like the Highlights magazines? Okay, good. No matter how old you get, there's still fun stuff in there. And there's one thing I like above all, and it's the hidden pictures page. It's the page where they've got all the hidden things, and then there's a column on the left, and they've got the different pictures that you're going to search for, and they're in there, but they're hidden. The title is a little misleading, because the pictures are never really hidden, are they? They're never like a fish like halfway behind something, or you can't. They're not hidden. They're there, fully formed. They're just so a part of their surroundings that you don't notice them at first. So let me tell you, sometimes as Christians, we feel as though we are vibrant because we don't purposefully hide our Christianity. Well, I'm not like so-and-so. I mean, when conversations get brought up in public, they turn around. They walk away, or they try to change the subject. They don't want to talk about their Christianity, and so they change it. They hide it on purpose. I'm not like that. I mean, I don't bring it up. I'm not actively bringing it up with people or talking, but I don't, you know, if they bring it up, I'll say something. See, here's the problem. You don't have to purposefully hide your Christianity for it to be worthless. All you have to do is become so a part of your surroundings that nobody notices you anymore. And when nobody notices you anymore, you cannot affect change. That's what it means to be the light of the world, to be the salt of the earth, to be able to stand out in such a way that people notice, take notice of the life that you live so that you can affect change. How does it happen that we reach that point? How does it happen that we reach the point where we're so a part of our surroundings that nobody notices us anymore? Somewhere between the time when we become Christians and later years of our Christian walk, we incur weights, the way that Hebrews 12 describes it, right? Hebrews 12, verse 1, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside the weights and the sin which so easily ensnare us, so that we can run with endurance the race set before us. But we don't run the race very well, or we stop, or we turn around, because we incur these different weights. We incur distractions, we incur temptations, relationships that are unhealthy, that hold us back, society, and the conformity that lies therein, all kinds of things that we let step in front of us and shake their head and say, no, you have to turn around at this point. Because these things are going to start getting in the way of your success at work, of your success financially. It's going to get in the way of your sports time, your me time, your friends time, your relationships, whatever. And we know that. And because of that, like Demas, we turn back. 2 Timothy 4, 9 through 10, Paul says, be diligent to come to me quickly, because Demas has forsaken me. Why? Because he loved this present world. He loved this present world. So we let these things wag a finger at us and tell us you have to turn around here. That's the way we think in our heads. I know that. I've been there, done that, and still do it. You get to this point where you realize that if you don't turn around here, if you don't stop, keep growing in your faith with Christianity, it's going to start to define you. It's going to start to be what people know about you and the first thing they think about when they see you. And when that happens, you can't take it off and put it in your pocket when you want to. By the time you've grown in your relationship with God and you've talked about it with other people to the point that that's who you are, not just what you do on some days of the week, you can't just take it off when you want. And we don't always like that, because it's pretty convenient to be able to take it off when I want and do the things that I want and live the way that I want. You see, we're afraid of that. And because we're afraid of that, faith does not always survive it. I believe that one of our biggest fears in Christianity is not that God cannot use us, but that he actually might. Yeah. You see, I've had that same fear. I still have it. Many times. It's not that God cannot use me. We're not afraid that if I put myself out there that I won't be useful, that God does not have enough power. We know, if you're a Christian, you know how big God is. You've seen people who step out there in faith and what God can do with that. You know he can use you. Your fear is that he might. That he might use me so big, he might push me in such a way that pushes me to places where I'm not comfortable. Or it pushes me to ask to give up too much. But God has given us a mission. He's given us a mission. Ephesians 2:10 says that we were created in Christ Jesus for good works. 1 Peter 3, verse 13 says that God looks for us to be eager to do good. Eager to do it. 2 Peter 1, 5 says, make every effort to put on these things, and he goes on to list these things to put on. But mission statements are not meant to be known. They're meant to be lived. You may know the mission statement of Christianity, but is it something you're living? When you remember back when the winter storms hit Birmingham, Alabama, just a little ways back, and it was so bad that, I mean, for miles, motorists were just stranded in the snow and ice, and they couldn't go anywhere. And local Chick-fil-A stores opened up their doors, and they got in there, and they fired up the grills, and they brought sandwiches, hundreds of sandwiches to motorists, and just fed them all for free. And then overnight, they had some of them come and stay in the restaurant. People slept on the floors. They slept on tables. They did all of these things. And many people were asking, what in the world are you guys doing? Spending all of this money, spending all of this time, and letting these people do these things for free, no penny. This is what Aubrey Pitt, the manager, said. This company is based on taking care of people and loving people before you're worried about money or profit. We were just trying to follow the model that we have all worked under for so long and the model that we've come to love. There was really nothing else we could have done but to try to help people in the way that we could. These employees knew what their mission was, but they were also eager to live it. They were eager to live it. So I want you to dig down and ask yourself this morning, am I content with knowing the mission of Christianity, or do I want to live it? Ask yourself, what kind of Christian do I want to be? What kind of faith do I want to have? I'm talking about figuring out for yourself what makes you tick and whether or not your life with God has something to do with that. Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 2, familiar verses to us, right? To everything there is a season and a purpose for everything under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die. And then Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 2 goes on to say, it's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting. Why? Because death is the end of all men, and the living will take this into account. In other words, given that death is certain, I wonder what highlights do I want memorialized in my obituary? I want you to answer the following questions in your head, and I will as well. I want you to complete the following statements in your own mind. I left the world a better place because I changed someone's life because God will say to me in the end, well done, good and faithful servant, because I, when I'm gone, people will remember that I. How do you finish these? Sometimes it takes realizing that life could end at any moment to make us wake up to really live, doesn't it? If you've ever had an experience like that, you realize the impact that it has on you. Ted Leonsis was the owner of the Washington Capitals. He made a fortune as an executive at AOL. But if you really want to know where his success comes from, you have to back up to 1983 when he was 25 years old. He was on an airplane that lost its wing flap ability and its landing gear. Not good. They shuffled around passengers. They moved stuff out of the overhead bins. They gave them a crash course in crash landings. And then he began to make a list. He promised himself, if I survive this, I will play offense for the rest of my life. And so when he was done and they survived that plane, he made a list of 101 things that he wanted to do. To this day, he has accomplished 72 of them on his list. Here's some of these goals. Fall in love and get married. Gain a worth of $100 million after taxes. Create the world's largest media company. Own a jet. Give $1 million to Georgetown University. Start a family foundation. Own a sports franchise. Produce a TV show. Invent a board game. Hold elective office. You just keep going on and on. One of those would be an incredible thing to accomplish. Owning a jet would be my first one, probably. Imagine if you decided to take the same mission statement to play offense with your life and applied it to your life with God. What could you accomplish? What could I accomplish if I decided that that was going to be my motto in life? That I would survive, not just surviving, but really living. How many of you ever put a puzzle together to find out at the end you're missing a piece? Frustrating, right? How does that make you feel? It's not good, right? You know what I do when I miss a piece? I go to the box with a Sharpie and I just go ahead and fill it in. And then it matches. It works. No, I don't do that. I have thought about it, though. I've been tempted enough. I put together a puzzle one time and I found that underneath the puzzle was the piece. I looked for it everywhere, and then I finally just broke the puzzle down, and then there it was, underneath the puzzle, sitting there. You know, failing to take the risks we should have taken in life, failing to reach out to the people we know we should reach out to, failing to study, pray, grow closer to God in the ways we should, is like losing a jigsaw piece puzzle in your life, and it leaves this gaping hole. And when you get to the end of life, have a feeling that all of the working we do will feel worthless if we miss the most important pieces. That conviction is supported by two social psychologists named Tom Gilovic and Vicky Medvec. They did research on what they call action regrets and inaction regrets. An action regret is something you do that you shouldn't. An inaction regret is something you didn't do that you should have. on any given day, action regrets outweigh inaction regrets. They outweigh them 53 to 47%. It's pretty close. But when they survey people at the end of their lives, inaction regrets outweigh the other 84 to 16%. In other words, your greatest regrets at the end of life, my greatest regrets at the end of life, will be the things we knew to do that we did not. You remember President Kennedy's inaugural address? Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. The Peace Corps was born out of that. And then you fast forward to today, and a 64-year-old Loisy Stocky said, "I never forgot that message. I tucked it away in my brain to act on someday. Today is my someday." That's a powerful statement. Forget everything else in your head right now. Today is your someday. Whatever it is in your life that may be lacking, whatever it is in your faith that you know needs building, today is your someday to work on that. If you're not a Christian, if you don't have the blood of Christ, and you know that at any moment life could be over, if Ecclesiastes 7:2 says this is what the living should take into account. This morning, Christ offers the opportunity to be ready, the opportunity to begin living life for Him, to play offense the way that He's done for us. This morning, if you have a faith that's not surviving, a faith that is dying, won't you let Christ help you? Won't you let all of these people in here who love you help you? We would love nothing more than to help you get started on that. If you need something this morning, today is your someday. Won't you let it be known while we stand and sing?